content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 4th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has a smiling Kim Jong-un. He is wearing the garb of a casino worker. He's got on a white shirt, black vest, black tie, and he's standing in front of a roulette wheel. There are some chips on the table, and then also some colored little, looks like rockets. The title of the cover story is The Big Gamble. Can Trump really get North Korea's Kim to give up his nukes? And that, in fact, is our first main story. We'll start right there. Kim puts denuclearization on the table. What happened? President Trump this week expressed cautious confidence that a planned head-to-head summit with Kim Jong-un will lead to a deal in which North Korea completely surrenders its nuclear weapons. The North Korean dictator announced last week he was shutting down a nuclear testing facility and suspending nuclear and intercontinental ballistic missile tests. He's also signaled that he is open to denuclearization if he receives guarantees his regime will not be attacked or toppled. Trump said the two countries were having good discussions and praised Kim for being very honorable. But he warned he would walk away from the summit, loosely scheduled for late May or early June, if he felt Kim wasn't serious about giving up his nuclear bombs and ICBMs. U.S. officials said the administration favored a Big Bang deal under which both sides would make major concessions early on, such as a trade of sanctions relief for Pyongyang in exchange for concrete steps toward the dismantling of the regime's nuclear program. "We'll see," said Trump. "Maybe it will be wonderful, or maybe it won't." Kim was expected to meet this week with South Korean President Moon Jae-in to negotiate a possible peace deal to formally end the Korean War, which was brought to a halt by an armistice in 1953. To show the thaw was real, the two countries set up a telephone hotline between their leaders for the first time, and so turned off the loudspeakers broadcasting propaganda along the border. What the editorial said: "Little Rocket Man may have blinked," said the New York Post. Granted, the portly dictator's good faith gesture to halt nuclear tests and ICBMs launches is easily reversible, but the fact that he is also putting out feelers about peace and recently told South Korea he wouldn't insist on a complete withdrawal of U.S. forces is cause for encouragement. The U.S. and U.N. sanctions have hit the regime hard, with factories closed and military units stranded without fuel. While we should be wary of trusting this sinister regime, Pyongyang may be getting ready to fold. "Don't be fooled," says the Weekly Standard. "Kim must be over the moon that the U.S. president accepted his offer of head-to-head talks, as it gives him the legitimacy and prestige he and his regime have always craved. Ultimately, there's no way Kim will willingly divest himself of nuclear weapons, which he sees as integral to his personal survival, his foreign policy, and his country's whole self-identity." Secretary of State nominee Mike Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton probably understand that. Does Trump? what the columnist said. Kim is playing Trump like a Stradivarius, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. The North Korean dictator knows our president thinks he alone can bring peace to the Korean Peninsula and that he'll seize on any apparent concession by Pyongyang as proof of his deal-making genius and superiority to previous presidents. So Kim is simply stringing Trump along with vague promises he has no intention of keeping, probably to buy more time to perfect his ICBM's ability to deliver nuclear payloads to U.S. cities. The Kim-Trump negotiations are bound to end in disaster, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. Trump thinks international politics is like real estate and is based on personal relations between the principals, when it's actually based on interests. It's not in Kim's interest to surrender the nukes he and his father have spent decades and billions developing. Yet Trump thinks if he can get in a room with Kim, he'll talk him into major concessions. When that fails, the embarrassed Trump will resume his fire and fury threats. The Kim-Trump summit is more likely to reframe the 70-year Korean standoff than to end it, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. Pyongyang will likely accept denuclearization as a goal in exchange for the U.S. lifting some sanctions right away and starting negotiations for a peace treaty. The key is the ICBM program. If Kim agrees to maintain his freeze on missile tests, Trump can claim a win, as he will have prevented North Korea from developing nukes that can hit U.S. cities. Critics will no doubt complain that this is more can-kicking than peacemaking, but in diplomacy, sometimes kicking is all you can do. The controversy of the week, titled this week, Starbucks Arrests, a case of implicit bias. Even in 2018, said Mickey Kendall in WashingtonPost.com, blacks and whites live in two different Americas. And in one, you can get arrested for sitting in a Starbucks. The latest proof that racism is alive and well came last week in a Philadelphia branch of the ubiquitous coffee chain. Two 23-year-old black men, Rashawn Nelson and Dante Robinson, arrived early at Starbucks for a business meeting and sat at a table to wait for a third party. 2 minutes later, the manager came over to ask if they were going to order anything. And when Nelson and Robinson said no, the manager told them to leave. She then called the police, who arrested the pair for trespassing, and detained them for 8 hours. Cell phone videos of the arrests triggered protests, threatened boycotts, and public contrition from Starbucks upper management. CEO Kevin Johnson apologized to Nelson and Robinson in person, announced that the offending manager has been fired, and that more than 8,000 Starbucks stores will close on May 29th, so that 170,000 employees can receive racial bias education. That corporate damage control campaign may save Starbucks' image, said Karen Ataya, also in WashingtonPost.com. But let's be honest. The routine harassment people of color experience in public spaces isn't a Starbucks problem. It's an American problem. Still, Starbucks deserves a lot of credit, said Leonard Pitts Jr. in the Miami Herald. Kevin Johnson and Howard Schultz, the chain's billionaire founder, could easily have blamed this debacle on the manager and declared the matter resolved by her firing. Instead, both bravely identified the real issue as implicit bias, the unconscious pervasive racism that causes even well-meaning white Americans to view black people as lesser dangerous others. Given how difficult it can be to get white people to even acknowledge the reality of implicit bias, Starbucks' bold stand deserves a standing ovation. No, it doesn't, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. Every honest observer knows that being black in America is a burden that you carry with you at all times. But the reaction to this single incident has been unhinged. How does anyone know that implicit bias caused the manager to ask the two men to leave? What if she was simply following Starbucks' official, if often unenforced, policy on table use by non-customers? Surely these are questions worth investigating before 170,000 employees are sentenced to re-education camp. Implicit bias is Orwellian junk science, said David French, also in NationalReview.com. Studies show people's scores on tests designed to measure unconscious racism change from test to test and have little value in predicting their behavior. There's also something very creepy about a corporation attempting not just to correct its employees' behavior, but form their minds. Fine, let's stop blaming implicit bias, said Shamira Ibrahim in NYMag.com. The whole concept only enables white people to dismiss racism as a mere accident of psychology rather than a purpose-built system of oppression and double standards that has yet to be dismantled. The fact that this all played out in a coffee shop is a grim irony of irony, said Anthony Stanford in ChicagoTribune.com. During the civil rights movement in the 1950s, blacks were spat on and arrested for trying to order coffee at a southern lunch counter. How far have we come since those shameful days? In the America of 2018, two black men were just humiliated and arrested for not ordering a cup of coffee. It was a good week for primate grooming when President Trump plucked what he called a speck of dandruff from the shoulder of visiting French President Emmanuel Macron. We have to make him perfect, said Trump, while Macron grinned awkwardly. It was a good week for juvenile astronomy jokes with the announcement by planetary scientists that Uranus smells. The planet's atmosphere, scientists say, is filled with hydrogen sulfide, the gas that gives rotten eggs and flatulence a distinctive odor. It was a good week for legal corruption after Trump administration official Mick Mulvaney urged bank executives to increase their donations to secure favorable legislation. If you're a lobbyist who never gave us money, I didn't talk to you, Mulvaney said of his own time in Congress. But it was a bad week for illegal corruption after former public employee Gilberto Escamilla, 53, of San Antonio, was sentenced to 50 years in prison for using taxpayer funds to buy $1.25 million worth of fajitas over 9 years, which he resold for profit. It started small and got bigger and out of control, Escamilla explained. It was a bad week for leaving the driving to us when a Greyhound bus left Cleveland bound for New York City and ended up 7 hours later, after a series of wrong turns and mechanical problems, in Toledo, which is in the opposite direction. It was a bad week for smuggling after a Colorado woman was fined $500 because she took an apple from an in-flight meal into the U.S. The customs officer asked me if my trip to Paris was expensive, said Cynthia Tadlock. Then he said, it's about to get a lot more expensive. And while we're here, there's only in America Peace. Penn State University has banned its venerable outing club from taking outdoor trips on the ground that they're too dangerous. The club, founded in 1920, has logged tens of thousands of miles of student-led hiking, canoeing, and camping expeditions. But after an assessment of risk management, PSU announced that the club's activities are above the university's threshold of acceptable risk. On the briefing page this week, we have the collusion question. Is President Trump right in saying there is no evidence his campaign team worked with Russia? What is collusion? Collusion is not a legal term, and it isn't a federal crime, except in antitrust law. What Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team is investigating is whether there was a conspiracy, secret cooperation, between the Trump campaign and Russia in violation of one or more federal laws, including a law prohibiting political campaigns from receiving something of value from foreign nationals. The underlying question investigators are trying to answer is whether there was a simple quid pro quo, Russia helping Trump win the election in exchange for his using the power of the presidency to drop economic sanctions and adopt friendly policies toward the Kremlin. What justifies that suspicion? U.S. intelligence agencies have already established that Russia sought to intervene in the 2016 presidential race to hurt Democrat Hillary Clinton and help Trump. During the race and after the election, the Trump campaign had an unusual amount of contact with Russians, at least 72 emails, phone calls, and other interactions, including 19 face-to-face meetings. In his sweeping investigation, Mueller is looking at a number of potential crimes, whether Trump campaign officials discussed with Russia the release of hacked Democratic emails, provided guidance for Moscow's disinformation campaign on social media, or accepted laundered campaign money or other help. Trump's prior financial dealings with Russians are also being examined as a possible source of influence or blackmail. So far, three Trump campaign officials have pled guilty to crimes related to Russia, and several aides, including Trump's son Donald Jr., are known to have expressed interest in receiving Russia's help. The key question, says former federal prosecutor Peter Zeidenberg, is whether this interest crossed over into intentional solicitation. What evidence is known? In June 2016, British publicist Rob Goldstone, who had extensive business ties in Russia, told Donald Trump Jr. in an email that as part of Moscow's support for his father, a Russian contact was offering documents and information that would incriminate Hillary Clinton. Trump Jr. responded enthusiastically, "If it's what you say, I love it," and forwarded the message to then-campaign manager Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law. The three men subsequently met in Trump Tower with Goldstone and four other people with Russian ties. U.S. sanctions against Russia were discussed, but Don Jr. insists the meeting produced nothing of interest or any follow-up contact. But even before that meeting, it's likely Trump's team knew Russia had potentially damaging dirt on Clinton and the Democrats. How so? Earlier in 2016, a UK-based professor who had been cultivated by the Kremlin told Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos that Russia had thousands of emails that would damage Clinton if released. The young aide triumphantly repeated that claim to an Australian diplomat whose subsequent tip-off sparked the FBI's investigation into the Trump campaign. Another key figure in this part of the investigation is Roger Stone, one of Trump's longtime advisors. Stone told a colleague in August 2016 that he had just met with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, a claim he later denied, and 3 weeks later tweeted that Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta would soon have his time in the barrel. Shortly afterward, WikiLeaks began publishing Podesta's hacked emails. In an interesting bit of timing, the emails were released less than an hour after Trump's embarrassing Access Hollywood tape became public. What other contacts occurred? Several Trump officials tried to set up back channels to Moscow during the post-election transition. Mike Flynn, Trump's first national security advisor, resigned when it was revealed that he had lied about discussing sanctions with then-Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak several weeks before Trump took office. In another message monitored by U.S. intelligence, Kislyak told the superiors that Kushner had proposed setting up a secret communications channel to the Kremlin in a Russian diplomatic facility. Mueller is also reportedly investigating contacts between Manafort aide Rick Gates and a former Russian intelligence officer and a January 2000 meeting in the Seychelles between Kremlin-linked Russian financier Kirill Dmitriev and Blackwater founder Eric Prince, a Trump ally. Adding to suspicions is the degree to which Trump's aides have lied about their many Russian contacts. What have they said? Top Trump campaign aide Jeff Sessions insisted during his confirmation hearings for Attorney General that he did not have communications with the Russians during the campaign, only to later admit he'd met with Kislyak at least twice. In a statement reportedly dictated by the president, Trump Jr. initially claimed the topic of the Trump Tower meeting was Russian adoptions, failing to mention the offer of dirt on Clinton. During the campaign, the senior Trump openly asked Russia for help, urging Moscow in a July 2, 2016 press conference to find 30,000 Clinton emails. Does any of this mean the president was involved in a crime? Until Mueller releases his findings, says Brookings Institution senior fellow Benjamin Witz, anyone who claims to know is talking out of an orifice other than their mouth. Time to read a few columns. First comes from the U.S. David Davenport at WashingtonExaminer.com writes, Democrats discover states' rights. With Republicans dominating Washington, Democrats have rediscovered states' rights, said David Davenport. While conservatives have long championed federalism, the belief that states should have some autonomy, today it's progressives railing about abuses of federal power. In fact, many of today's big political battles are, at their base, a federalism tug-of-war pitting the federal government against state and local governments. States, counties, and cities are actively fighting the Trump administration's attempt to crack down on illegal immigration. State attorneys general also took the lead challenging Trump's travel ban. Under federal law, marijuana is still illegal. But 30 states and the District of Columbia have legalized cannabis in some fashion. States are even pursuing their own climate change policies as the Trump administration seeks to dismantle environmental regulation. The left shouldn't abandon federalism the moment a Democrat regains the White House. State and local control can soothe our overheated national politics by allowing red and blue America to live and let live. After decades of power moving to Washington, it would be healthy and refreshing to see the pendulum swing back towards state and local governments. This comes from Germany. Admit that refugees bring anti-Semitism. You can't wear a Jewish skullcap on your head in Berlin without being beaten up, said Marita Adam Telik. That's the horrifying conclusion we must draw from the viral video posted last week by an Israeli Arab. Adam Armush, who lives in Berlin, said he wanted to prove that Jews wouldn't be harassed in Germany if they openly identified as Jews. So he borrowed a friend's yarmulke and went for a stroll. It wasn't long before three men, at least one of them a Syrian refugee, began yelling Jew at him in Arabic and beat him with a belt. Armush caught the attack on film. Of course, such anti-Semitic violence wasn't unknown in Germany before the 2015 influx of mostly Muslim refugees. We've long struggled with the disgusting extreme right-wing German hatred of the Jews, as well as leftist hatred, often disguised as criticism of Israel. But overt anti-Semitic acts are now more common, as the native and immigrant strains of anti-Semitism complement and reinforce each other. We do the immigrants no favor by failing to acknowledge and denounce the bigotry they have brought with them. Worse, we fail our own Jewish residents. Germans should all don the yarmulke in solidarity with their Jewish neighbors. Civilization needs protection against barbarism. This is from China, making us take Taiwan by force. The U.S. had better rethink its reckless policy toward Taiwan, said Su Tan. Last week, live fire drills in the Taiwan Straits, the first China has held in 2 years, be a warning. The exercise was necessary because Washington has upped its military and security cooperation with Taiwan to the most intimate and dangerous level since 1979. Not only did the U.S. pass a law in March that allows top Taiwanese officials to visit their counterparts in America and vice versa, a violation of the One China policy, under which the U.S. agreed not to recognize Taiwanese sovereignty, it also approved the sale of advanced submarine technology to Taiwan. Such measures have emboldened separatists in Taiwan to become more aggressive and arrogant in their secession attempts. And that is dangerous for Taipei. Taiwan is part of China and will one day be reunified with the motherland, peacefully, we hope, but by force if necessary. Secessionists on the island must understand the more support they receive from Washington, the earlier they will see their doomsday coming. Taiwanese leader Tsai Ing-wen said recently that Taiwan is not simply a U.S. pawn, but a chess player in its own right. If she moves toward independence, we will tell her, game over. Our in-depth article, the last word feature, titled this week, Saving Hawking's Voice. In 2014, a Silicon Valley engineer got an unexpected call, said journalist Jason Fagone. Could he help rescue physicist Stephen Hawking's distinctive voice before aging technology lost it forever? Eric Dorsey, a 62-year-old engineer in Palo Alto, California, was watching TV in mid-March when he started getting texts that Stephen Hawking had died. He turned on the news and saw clips of the famed physicist speaking in his iconic Android voice, the voice that Dorsey had spent so much time as a young man helping to create, and then, much later, to save from destruction. Dorsey and Hawking had first met 30 years earlier, nearly to the day. In March 1988, Hawking was visiting the University of California, Berkeley, during a three-week lecture tour. At 46, Hawking was already famous for his discoveries about quantum physics and black holes, but not as famous as he was about to be. His bestseller, A Brief History of Time, was a week away from release, and Californians were curious about this British professor from the University of Cambridge, packing the seats of his public talks, approaching him at meals. When Hawking spoke, it was in the voice of a robot, a voice that emerged from a gray box fixed to the back of his motorized wheelchair, the voice synthesizer, a commercial product known as the Call Text 5010, was a novelty then, not yet a part of his identity. He'd begun using it just 3 years before, after the motor neuron disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, stole his ability to speak. Hawking selected bits of text on video screen by moving his cheek, and Call Text turned the text into speech. At the start of one lecture, Hawking joked about it. "The only problem," he said, to big laughs, "is that it gives me an American accent." Dorsey was with Hawking for part of that trip, tagging along as a sort of authority on the voice, explaining its workings to journalists. He worked at the Mountain View, California company that manufactured the Call Text 5010, a hardware board with two computer chips running custom software. An upbeat 32-year-old, Dorsey was quiet by nature, but driven. He had joined Speech Plus as an intern, attracted by its mission to help the voiceless and the disabled. Now he led a team of engineers, and at least 20,000 lines of code were in the Call Text. At the end of his California tour, the physicist gave Dorsey a signed copy of his new book, his thumbprint pressed into the inside cover. Hawking returned to Cambridge, Dorsey to his life in California. 26 years went by before they would cross paths again. In tech years, that is a millennium. The internet happened. Silicon Valley boomed, busted, boomed again. Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, Uber. Dorsey, meanwhile, left Speech Plus, which went bankrupt and was sold to a series of other companies. He got married and had kids. He joined a Buddhist temple. He eventually left the field of speech technology altogether, becoming an engineering leader at DVR maker TiVo. Tech, he'd learned, moves so fast. "There's a new iPhone every year," Dorsey says. "Everything just kind of gets buried in the dustbin of history very, very quickly." That's why when an email from Cambridge University arrived out of the blue in 2014, Dorsey was surprised. It came from Hawking's technical assistant, Jonathan Wood, who was responsible for Hawking's communications systems. Wood explained something so improbable that Dorsey had trouble understanding at first. Hawking was still using the Call Text 5010 speech synthesizer, a version last upgraded in 1986. In nearly 30 years, he had never switched to a newer technology. Hawking liked the voice just the way it was and had stubbornly refused other options. But now the hardware was showing wear and tear. If it failed, his distinctive voice would be lost to the ages. The solution, Wood believed, was to replicate the decaying hardware in new software to somehow transplant a 30-year-old voice synthesizer into a modern laptop without changing the sound of the voice. What did Dorsey think? 30 years old, he thought. Oh, my God. It wouldn't be easy. They might have to locate old source code. They might have to find the original chips and the manuals for those chips. They couldn't buy them anymore. The companies don't exist. Solving the problem might mean mounting an archaeological dig through an antiquated era of technology. But it was for Stephen Hawking. "Let's get it done," Dorsey said. Today's synthesized voices, like Apple's Siri, rely on pre-recorded libraries of natural sound. Voice actors record huge libraries of words and syllables, and software chops them up and reassembles them into sentences on the fly. But 30 years ago, computers could produce only a stick figure version of a human voice, said Patty Price, a speech recognition specialist in Palo Alto. Back then, she worked as a postdoc in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology lab of Dennis Klatt, a tall, thin, opera-loving scientist originally from Wisconsin. Klatt is the godfather of Hawking's voice. He blasted his own throat with X-rays to measure the shape of his voice box as he articulated certain sounds and then developed a software model of speech, the Klatt model, based on his own voice. Speech Plus took Klatt's model, improved on it, commercialized it, including the Caltex 5010. One of Dorsey's contributions was to write an algorithm that controlled the intonation of the voice, the rise and fall of words and sentences. Speech Plus would sell thousands of Caltex systems, though many customers complained that the voice sounded too robotic. But Hawking liked it. True, it was robotic, but he appreciated that it was easy to understand. Noise robust, as Price explains. The shape of its waveform was more like a series of plateaus than the steep mountain cliffs of human voices, which fall off more sharply. The flattish slope of Hawking's voice made it cut through noise in amphitheaters and lecture halls. "It's very intelligible," Dorsey says. "You can listen to it for a long time, and it's not irritating." Over the years, Hawking had chances to upgrade. In 1996, a Massachusetts speech technology company called Nuance, which had acquired the remains of Speech Plus, upgraded the Caltex with evolved software code that made the voice sound fuller and faster, less robotic, with shorter pauses between sentences. They sent Hawking a sample of the new voice, thinking he'd be pleased. He was not. He said the intonation wasn't right. He preferred the 1986 voice. Starting around 2009, Wood and several others at Cambridge began trying to separate Hawking's voice from the failing Caltex hardware. The group would include Peter Binney, a computer guru at the university, Powell Wozniak, a local engineering student, and Mark Green, an experienced electrical engineer with Intel. One option they considered was tweaking a modern synthetic voice like Siri to sound more like Hawking. But Siri-type systems rely on the vast computer power of internet clouds, and Hawking couldn't be constantly tethered to the internet. Binney also tried a completely different approach. He wrote a software emulator for the Caltex, essentially a program that would fool a modern PC into thinking it was actually the old Caltex. But the samples it produced didn't sound faithful enough for Hawking's taste. By the time Cambridge reached out to Dorsey in 2014, they were investigating a third avenue: track down the old Caltex source code, now owned by Nuance, and port it to Hawking's laptop, transplanting the old voice into a fresh new body. Was it possible? Dorsey had no idea. It depended on whether he could find the source code or, failing that, information that would let him reverse engineer the source code. He started emailing colleagues he hadn't seen in 30 years, asking if they had any Caltex bric-a-brac still lying around. Boards, chips, manuals. One guy found an actual Caltex board in his garage. Others located dusty schematics. It had the feel of a mad scramble through an earlier era of technology, but people everywhere leaped at the chance to help. "The goal is to save his voice," Dorsey said. "Once you go to somebody, I need you to help save Stephen Hawking's voice," they immediately wake up. Dorsey's archaeological quest for old code turned out to be a frustrating one. No one at Nuance was able to find the source code from the 1986 version of Call Text. They did, however, find the code for the upgraded 1996 version of the voice on a backup tape in an office in Belgium. After a few months of work, Nuance engineers got the code up and running and sent a series of audio samples to Hawking's team, adjusting the program and trying to match the 1986 voice. It didn't quite work. The match was close, but not perfect. Hawking flagged subtle differences others had trouble discerning. "It's like recognizing your mother's voice," Price said. "When you hear them over the phone, you know if that's right or not." At this point, they switched tacks and returned to one of their original ideas, to emulate the call text in software, similar to how PCs can emulate old Nintendo games that aren't sold anymore. The call text, of course, was a more intricate beast than a Nintendo, driven by two obsolete and complexly interacting chips, one made by Intel and the other by NEC. Building the emulator demanded heroic feats of programming, intuition, and high-tech surgery. The chips had to be removed from a spare call text board with tweezers and a screwdriver. An emulator for the Intel chip had to be written from scratch by Benny. A separate emulator for the NEC was borrowed from an open-source Nintendo emulator. Then all these disparate pieces had to be glued together. The breakthrough came just before Christmas 2017, when the emulator finally started producing sounds that resembled the familiar voice they had been chasing. It had some minor glitches, but the voice was an acoustical match to Hawking's, the waveforms virtually identical. On January 17th, the team felt ready to demonstrate the new voice for Hawking. Wood, Wozniak, and Benny went to Hawking's home in Cambridge and played him samples on a Linux laptop. To the team's relief and happiness, Hawking gave his blessing. They still needed to port the voice to the PC, so temporarily, Wood loaded a version onto a miniature hardware board known as a Raspberry Pi. He thought Hawking might want to evaluate the voice in everyday life, and the Pi was the quickest way to get him up and running. On January 26, Wood took the Pi along to Hawking's house and asked if he'd like to try it out. Hawking raised his eyebrows, which meant yes. The team put the Pi in a tiny black box, attached it to Hawking's chair with Velcro, and plugged it into the voice box. Then they disconnected the call text. For the first time in 33 years, Hawking was able to speak without it. Wood watched eagerly for Hawking's reaction. "I love it," Hawking said. For the next few weeks in private conversations, Hawking continued to speak through the emulator and the Raspberry Pi, chatting happily with friends and colleagues. All that remained, the final step of the project, was to get the PC version, still a bit buggy, working smoothly. But after a few more code revisions, it was finally bug-free. And that is when Hawking got sick in February. According to Wood, Hawking continued using the emulator until his final days. He was able to talk with his loved ones and caregivers with the new software. The original call text boards have passed to Hawking's estate to use as his family wishes. So has the new software, the call text emulator, which can be ported to future platforms as they are invented. Hawking was famously an atheist, skeptical of the afterlife. "We had this one life to appreciate the grand design of this universe," he once said, "and for that I am extremely grateful. But there is no longer any physical reason his voice can't live forever." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you. And we'll read one of the obituaries this week. The formidable first lady who raised a president. Barbara Bush, 1925 to 2018. With her brilliant white hair and trademark fake pearls, Barbara Bush was viewed by many Americans as the nation's kindly grandmother. But within the Bush family, she was known as the enforcer. As the matriarch of one of the nation's most powerful families, Bush employed her own considerable political skills to help her husband, George H.W. Bush, and her eldest son, George W. Bush, rise to the presidency. Throughout her husband's career, Bush meticulously maintained an index card library detailing the family's social and fundraising contacts. When George H.W. finally reached the White House in 1989, their Christmas card list had grown to more than 10,000 names. She was an equally adept campaigner, winning over crowds with her down-to-earth manner and self-deprecating humor. After becoming First Lady at age 63, she noted that she had become a role model for a particular cohort of American women. "My mail," she said, "tells me a lot of fat, white-haired, wrinkled ladies are tickled pink." The daughter of a publishing executive father, Barbara Pierce grew up in the Tony New York City bedroom community of Rye, said USA Today. She had a difficult relationship with her domineering mother, whose barbed comments about her youthful chubbiness left the future First Lady with a lasting sensitivity about her weight. At 16, she caught sight of George H.W. during a Christmas dance at a Connecticut country club, said the Washington Post. She later called him her first love and said he was the only boy she ever kissed. The following year, George enlisted in the Navy and trained as a pilot. He named the torpedo bomber that he flew in the South Pacific Barbara. The couple married in 1945, and the bride, not yet 20, dropped out of Smith College. "The truth is, I just wasn't interested," she said in interviews. "I was just interested in George." After World War II, the Bushes moved to the Texas oil patch to seek their fortune, said the Associated Press. Barbara was often left to manage their five children on her own. A sixth child, Robin, died in 1953 of leukemia at age 3, as George's ambitions carried him from business to the highest levels of politics, including appointments as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, CIA Director, and Ronald Reagan's Vice President. "This was a period for me of long days and short years," she said, "of diapers, runny noses, earaches, more Little League games than you could believe possible." Bush made more sacrifices as First Lady, staying quiet about contentious issues, including her rumored support for abortion rights, when her opinion was said to differ from her husband's, said the New York Times. She was vocal, however, in championing causes of her choosing. She was a passionate supporter of literacy campaigns, having seen her son Neil struggle with dyslexia, and promoted AIDS awareness when the disease was still highly stigmatized. After her husband lost his bid for re-election to Bill Clinton in 1992, the Bushes built a home in Houston, and she delighted in being away from politics, said Los Angeles Times. Still, George W. repeatedly called on his mother for advice while campaigning for and serving in the White House. When another son, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, prepared to run in 2016, she appeared more reluctant, telling an interview with characteristic bluntness, "We've had enough Bushes." Nevertheless, she supported his decision once it was made and attacked rival Republican candidate Donald Trump as a hate monger, demonstrating an aggressiveness that many wished to see from Jeb. She stayed smitten with George H.W. until the end, and their 73-year marriage is the longest in presidential history. 60 years after their wedding, She described her husband as that 80-year-old whirlwind who makes my life sing. And we'll go right on over to the Talking Points page. Haley, building her own brand. Another week, another humiliation of a Trump cabinet official at the hands of the president, said Matt Lewis in the DailyBeast.com. Trump's latest victim is Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. 2 weeks ago, Haley announced on CBS's Face the Nation that new sanctions would be imposed on Russia, Russian companies that may have helped manufacture the chemical weapons Bashar al-Assad recently used on Syrian civilians. President Trump reportedly was enraged by her statement, and 2 days later, Larry Kudlow, Trump's new economic advisor, said no decision had been made on new sanctions, suggesting that Haley had been suffering from momentary confusion. Haley defiantly retorted, "With all due respect, I don't get confused." It's Trump, of course, who is confused about Russia sanctions and so much else, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. Our erratic president obviously reversed the sanctions decision and in the process made Haley look like a fool. Actually, said Molly Roberts in WashingtonPost.com, this incident was a coup for Haley. Not only did she force an apology out of Kudlow, a rarity in this administration, she positioned herself as a truth teller apart from a cabal of liars, and a woman who can stand up to Trump. That may make her immune to the ignominy that has befallen many a member of the Trump administration. During the 2016 campaign, said A.B. Stoddard of RealClearPolitics.com, Haley, an Indian American, was an outspoken critic of Trump's racially charged rhetoric. Since he named her ambassador to the UN, she has pointedly not stooped to the sycophancy most of her colleagues have. Haley clearly intends to preserve and burnish her reputation for the future. That future might include a 2020 presidential candidacy, said Pamela Falk in TheHill.com. The former South Carolina governor has strong credentials, and if she can now build a reputation for principled independence from Trump, she could be perfectly positioned to make an Oval Office run of her own. Her problem is that Trump knows it, said E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. White House aides have been whispering that he's uneasy with her ambition, and that was even before Haley pushed back hard on the sanctions. If she's serious about running for president, Haley should consider leaving this listing ship on her own terms, before Trump makes her look bad, perhaps on purpose next time. Tax cuts, not helping the GOP. Somehow Republicans managed to pass a tax cut that most Americans don't like, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. When President Trump signed the GOP tax reform bill late last year, polls showed it to be even less popular than the tax hikes passed under George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Republicans hoped that would change as soon as Americans started seeing more money in their paychecks, but voters are still dubious. Today, just 27% of Americans say the tax cuts are a good idea, while 53% think they will have a negative impact by causing deficits to rise while lavishing disproportionate benefits on the rich. This is a harrowing development for the GOP. If Republicans can't sell voters on tax cuts, their one significant legislative accomplishment of the Trump era, what are they supposed to sell them? How about even more tax cuts, said Lauren DeBillis Appel in FoxNews.com. Congressional Republicans had to let the cuts for individuals expire in 2025 for budget and procedural reasons, but are mulling legislation that would make those cuts permanent. They should, because taxpayers need to be reminded who's on their side. The Treasury Department estimates that take-home pay has increased 90% of Americans, has increased for 90% of Americans. More money in your pocket is a winning message. Unfortunately, that message alone won't cut it, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. The tax cuts will be almost a year old by the midterms, and Republicans have no other policy agenda in the works to give Americans a reason to vote for them, despite controlling Congress and the White House. Republicans are resting on their laurels when they don't deserve any laurels. It looks like voters are no longer buying the GOP's snake oil, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. For decades, Republicans have sold tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations as a magical elixir that produces so much economic growth that they pay for themselves and trickle down into big pay raises for the middle class. But the deficit is now projected to soar to more than $1 trillion by 2020, thanks in large part to the tax bill. Corporations are pocketing billions in tax relief without sharing much of it with employees. So what will Republicans run on in the midterms in November? Expect more white identity politics. In the Trump era, it's all the GOP has left. And we'll round out the hour with a quote or two from Benjamin Franklin. So convenient a thing to be a reasonable creature, since it enables one to find or make a reason for everything one has a mind to do. And this one from George Washington. He says, it is better to offer no excuse than a bad one. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.